Hello and welcome to Boomeranging, from expat to repat, a podcast that explores the question, what could be so hard about returning home after years living overseas? I'm your host, Margot Anderson, and in each episode, I will sit down with a former Aussie expat to discuss how they survived repatriation and reverse culture shock, how they navigated the logistics of careers, friends, and family to successfully find their new place at home, and all without losing their global spirit. If you have just returned home, are thinking about it, or just love a good yarn told by professional globetrotters, then I have no doubt you'll enjoy meeting this diverse group of Australians. When Andrew Tiernan was overseas and would talk to recruiters and his Australian networks about roles back home, he often heard, "But why would you want to come home?" Turns out, one of the perils of a phenomenal career overseas is that people back home don't quite understand your why for returning to Australia. This was Andrew's experience, certainly in the first two times he tried to come home during his 18 years overseas. The third time, he was a little more direct. "We are coming home regardless of what the welcome is." Today I talk to Andrew about the challenges he and his husband faced in their long journey to return to Australia, and what considerations they set to guide their journey and to make sure the move was the right one for both of them. I also talked to Andrew about his decision to leave his corporate career behind and launch a startup and the role his networks have played in supporting him with this next ambition. So welcome, Andrew.
Hello, Margot.
Great to have you here. Where are we chatting with you today?
From sunny Melbourne.
Sunny Melbourne. Sunny autumn days. We take them when we can get them, don't we?
Fabulous.
Before we dive into your international story, can you cast your mind back, I guess 20 years ago now, to what life and career looked like for you before you set off on your first adventure to Hong Kong?
Sure. I grew up in a small beach town in northern New South Wales, and when everybody asked me, "What do you want to do when you grow up?" my answer was simply just go to university, because I knew there was not one anywhere near my town. I did uni in Sydney, spent 10 fantastic years working at MLC. And that was a career that spanned distribution, product, you know, the advent of the internet. And I held some pretty good roles there working for phenomenal people. And then I was in the corporate strategy team when National Australia Bank bought MLC. And that was kind of it. Then that just exploded my world.
The doors opened from there.
The doors opened and the opportunities opened, I guess.
Did you ever think you would pursue a career or a life overseas, or did that take you by surprise?
I always knew I would. I left Byron Bay when I was 17 to be an exchange student in Surabaya in Indonesia.
Oh, right.
So that was 1 year living with a fantastic family in a completely different culture, living with a Muslim family, going to a high school where English wasn't spoken. So I kind of got that flavor early on, but I also was youngest of six kids, and most of my siblings had all done the backpacking tours and worked overseas for extended periods of time, sometimes, you know, 6 or 7 years. But for me, I liked the security and I wanted the foundation of a career before I worked overseas. So I guess I knew it was always going to happen, but I wanted to have something behind me before it did.
So you head to Hong Kong, if I'm right, initially for a 6 week contract.
Yeah, that's right.
That 6 weeks turns into 18 years. So that's a big difference.
Yeah.
It was across multiple countries too, wasn't it? You know, it wasn't just Hong Kong. So can you share with us how that unfolded and I guess what the impetus was to stay for so long?
It was kind of a little bit like a snowball. I got a contract, or I was asked to go up and help the team in Hong Kong do some strategy work across the region. We did a short, sharp piece of strategy work, and the answer was for the most growth for NAB, and the NAB group would be in China. So the CEO at the time said, "Well, do you want to hang around and be part of that? But if that is the case, then you know you might need to go to Beijing." So I headed to Beijing for 18 months, 2 years, running the development team there, a lot of research and business development and policy work, helping create the narrative for what does China mean for the National Australia Bank. And then after that, I was tapped on the shoulder to say, "Okay, well, you've done that for China. Do you want to come now down and do that in Hong Kong for the whole region?"
Great, great.
So that then became a series of opportunities and projects. Fantastic job with a lot of different focus. So I held that position for probably 10 years, and there was a mixture of business development. There was a mixture of corporate strategy, running the corporate planning process, supporting the CEO's office. And that took me, as you said, Margot, that took me to places like Indonesia and India and Singapore, where I lived for a short time as well. Tokyo, wherever it might be in Asia that the National Australia Bank had some interest. So it was pretty easy at the time to just keep saying yes when you get tapped on the shoulder to say, hey, could you look at this for us or could you look at that?
Yeah, and the diversity was rich and it was just keeping you there.
Extremely rich. And also, pardon the pun, there was the boomerang back to Melbourne a lot. So being part of the global strategy team also saw me in places like New York and London but predominantly back in Australia at least four times a year. So it was very easy to spend time with family, to maintain those connections back in Australia. So you didn't feel like you were stuck overseas.
And you also went on to Canada at some point in your career as well?
Yeah, towards the end of my tenure, I'd done 20 years at National Australia Bank. And when I was asked to move back to Australia then with the bank, I had just met someone and I didn't necessarily think it was fair asking him to, pick up his life and just move to a new country as literally the month we started dating. And I'd known Derek for quite a few years, so I was kind of pretty sure that he was the one. So I stayed in Hong Kong and I started working for Manulife and I set up their strategy team and their project office and ended up running delivery services actually for that whole team, which was about a staff of 120 people. And I hadn't done that for a long time. And again, when change came, I was asked to move to Toronto and join the corporate strategy team there and do something that no one at the National Australia Bank would have ever let me do. I ran their $4.5 billion cost carve-out program.
Excellent.
No one would have ever let me near a spreadsheet or numbers like that. but again, that was an adventure for Derek and I, and we had certain aspirations to try something different, to go on an adventure together. But that didn't necessarily work out the way we wanted it to.
Well, you also had the COVID factor at play, didn't you? That was a tough one in that scenario.
Yeah, there were a few dominoes that sort of fell the other way.
And I mean, look, we move our careers overseas, but we move our lives overseas too. So there was obviously a love of living in these places that you were in. What were some of the highlights for you from a lifestyle perspective?
I don't want to sound rude or too pompous, but look, from a lifestyle perspective, Derek worked at Cathay Pacific for many years and yep. I was traveling sometimes just as much as he was, if not more. So we did have an amazing opportunity to very cheaply travel the world. So there was the obvious things of on a holiday, on a whim, having weekends away. And Margaret, you know what it's like when you live in a hub city and the opportunities to just bounce down to Bangkok for lunch.
Yeah, yeah.
In a way, it's quite tempting. So, look, we did travel far and wide. We had a great network of friends around the world that we could go visit. Just the opportunities to balance working quite hard in quite stressful environments and in environments where you don't speak the language. And it is challenging, despite I'm talking it up a little bit. But there were times that were really tough and times that were really heart-wrenching through my time overseas. But you balance that out with, well, let's have as much fun as we can.
Yeah, that good old work hard, play hard kind of.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you did try to come home to Australia on two different occasions, and it was the third time that proved to be successful. What was the difference, do you think, in the approach? What was it that made this attempt to come home more successful?
Well, I think the first two times I was searching for my career. I wanted to move back to Australia for family reasons, or I thought I'd been overseas long enough, and I wanted to keep progressing my career. And I think the third time, Manulife had gone through a massive cost-cutting program. My whole team was cut within 18 months of me being there. We had COVID arrive. We had my father go into surgery. And I do remember the phone call from my mum when she said, look, your dad's just about to have an operation. He'd like to speak to you. And then, he's already gone under. And we weren't sure if he was going to come out of that. And I think that was the trigger that said, we are going home. And even if it wasn't to Australia, we're going back to our time zone where we can interact with our families and be close with our families. And then I think as COVID got worse and worse and restrictions became harder and more stricter, then it was a case of saying, no, look, we have to go home. There's no choice. And I think the difference there was, rather than reaching out to my networks and saying, hey, I'd like to come home, you know, what's available? This time I made a list actually of about 7 or 8 people who I really regarded, who I'd worked either for or with throughout my career. And I sent a message to each of them to say, I need to come home. I just don't know how. And this time I wasn't looking for a platform. My husband, you know, Derek, encouraged me, look, let's go back and spend the final years around your family, because I'd spent 10 years with his family, in effect. So it was like, hey, it's time to spend time with your family and really reconnect. And it was humbling, but pretty easy to reach out to people and say, look, I need help.
Yeah, great. I think you and I have had this conversation before that, you know, our networks genuinely want to help us. They often just don't know how. And so when we do create space for them to contribute ideas and alternatives, the conversations take on a different meaning or a different level of help, because they're not thinking, oh, you're looking for X job or X title. There's a little bit more freedom to sort of explore opportunities.
Yeah, I'd agree. And particularly in that instance, you know, I was sitting in, you know, a room not dissimilar to the one I'm sitting in now in our home in Toronto. And within a 2-week period, I think I must have had 12, maybe even 14 video calls with people who recommended me to other people. And everybody understood, look, we understand you need to come home. Everyone understood how difficult COVID was. And people really thought laterally for me. They introduced me to people that they may not have introduced to me before.
So you create that ripple effect then, don't you?
Yeah.
Melbourne is not your hometown. Derek is not from Australia. So why Melbourne? Why not Sydney, where you'd lived before, or, you know, another area that was familiar to you?
I think for us, we went to Toronto together to both change the trajectory of life. And that included trying to have a family, you know, trying to do some surrogacy. And we made that decision to do that together, to both see, look, what could going somewhere together to somewhere neither of us had been before, you know, what would that be like? The times that we really, really enjoyed our holidays together was when we went to a place where neither of us had been. And to be honest, there were a few of those.
Yeah.
So when the time came to move to Australia, I guess there was one little bit that said, you know, I worked for NAB and I was conscious of the head office environment, and a lot of people who worked in Asia for NAB had all come from Melbourne. So there was a network of people here I knew, but I didn't know the city. Even though, you know, with flying, you know, Derek's layovers in Sydney were 4 days, here they were one. So he knew Sydney a lot better as well. But we thought, look, if we're going to make this an adventure again, look, let's go somewhere where neither of us know the place, where we can start to find it together, as opposed
to mutual ground.
As mutual ground, as opposed to me saying, hey, look, let me show you all these things I know.
And I know that through our conversations, you've also talked about how it was really important that Derek had his own reasons. Can you talk to us about what that looked like or what that meant for you in terms of making that a successful move?
Yeah, I think one of the things we did wrong in Canada was we went for my job and we just assumed Derek would pick up work because he's really smart and he's got a great career in F&B. In that 2 years, he couldn't find any work at all because, you know, you're not Canadian. He ended up working on TV and movies, etc., and modeling sets because that was the only work he was given. So when we were coming back during COVID, we spent a year in Taipei because he wasn't allowed into Australia. And we thought long and hard about, look, should we stay in Asia? Should we, look, Canada didn't work out the way we thought. We were worried that Australia might be the same, but we still had that conviction, no, we're going home. So for us, it was having a long dialogue about what does success look like for Derek as well. And for Derek, it was, I want to see how good I can be. I want to work in an environment where people value performance, which he hadn't necessarily worked in that environment before.
And has it been a success for him?
So far, yes.
Yeah, great.
So we had Yeah, so he's working in a field that he is excellent at, and he's loving it, and he knows more about Melbourne than I do.
Amazing, amazing. And I think you made a promise, didn't you, to each other that you'd kind of give it a year and then reevaluate?
Yeah. When we were settling on the city, I said, look, please just give me 1 year in Melbourne, and if it doesn't work, happily, let's go to Sydney. And when the year came up, I said, hey, all right, we've been here a year now. What do you think? He's going, we're not moving. I've got a great job.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. That's great to hear.
Yes.
You've talked extensively about the fact that you still maintained a level of high connection with your network here in Melbourne. What preparation and conversations did you have with them while you lived overseas? So just before, so if we take away that sort of conversation of like, I've got to come home, but prior to that, what did that look like? What are your reflections of that?
I think it was certainly whilst I was in Asia, there was always the flow of executives from either the bank or from MLC or from our clients who were coming through. So I was sort of a known entity, sort of socially, I guess. And that is a great way to build relationships. And also, when I was coming back to Australia, there was executive education programs, there were board meetings, there was a whole lot of opportunities to spend time and quality time with people. And I do enjoy being social. So there was always a case of making sure that someone had time for a beer or coffee. But then towards the end, I think that kind of narrowed down into thinking about, okay, well, who's been through what I've been through? And just making sure that I was touching base with people who'd been through similar experiences or who had worked very closely with me and knew the value I could bring.
And so when you came home, you hadn't completely removed the idea or the notion of a corporate career, but you also had a business plan ready to go for a new business. What was the tipping point? What made you go in the direction of the new business?
Well, I think for a year, you know, for a year when we were knocking on the door trying to come into Australia and Derek wasn't allowed to, I designed a platform that ostensibly started with a contract basis. So simplifying contracts and agreement, helping people deliver what they say they'll do, because we'd had some really bad experiences in selling our house in Toronto, in getting Derek's visas into Australia, in renting some properties, etc. Everything that we felt we were coming up against, all the brick walls, all were because people weren't actually doing what they said they'd do contractually. So I designed the business that I've now got. I designed it in anger. I was really angry. You know, I was angry at the world. I was angry at people I was dealing with. And I thought, look, I know technology. There's got to be a better way than this. That's when I was sitting in Taipei when we did this. And that's when we were still making phone calls on how to get home, what's the right thing to do. Derek became very ill. He had his own business in Taipei. He was exhausted. Well, he found himself in the hospital at one point where he passed away in the ambulance. And a couple of days later, he passed away in ICU. And because of that, thankfully revived.
So there is a good news story here.
because of that experience, a lot of people who knew me reached out to me and really understood what we were going through. And actually, just in conversations with quite a few of those people, that said, look, how are you keeping yourself busy? So after, you know, after a sob story of 40 minutes about what my husband's going through and what had done for us, I'd actually say at the end of each call, well, do you want to see what I've been building? Do you want to see what I've been designing? And a few of those people said, well, come and talk to my people. Like, let's have a look at what you have. So we already had a foundation client agreeing to help us establish the business when I arrived. But the trigger is really then when I arrived, I came with my CV and my business plan, and I wasn't sure which way to go. And in that first week of arriving back in Melbourne, which I think was the first week of opening up, so the week after lockdown, I think it was the last November in 2021, I reached out to a whole bunch of friends in Melbourne, and every one of them said, yes, let's catch up. And I think the first one was with a, you know, really close mate, he and his wife. I'd known for years, and they used to be consultants and then worked in the bank, and I talked them through where I was at, and they were just going, throw your CV away. Like, what are you doing? You still got the opportunity. Run for it. And then the second one was with, I had a dinner the next night with a great guy who was the CEO of a firm who said, if you can deliver and dream what you've just talked about, we'll be your client. Then that just happened every single day. By the end of the week, I'd just thrown out my CV completely.
Pathways Digital is the business, and it was born, I guess, through, you know, that good old saying of, you know, necessity is the birthplace of, you know, innovation.
Yes.
Can you talk us through what Pathways Digital looks like today?
Pathways is a cloud-based platform that is essentially a window between somebody's business and their customers. But at the spine of it is your contractual agreements. So simplifying that contract and agreement in common language speak that gives your customer a window to what I'm promising to deliver to you, but then give your team a full work plan behind that. And that includes, you know, this might not happen until this happens, or, you know, making sure you're ticking off all of the activities that need to occur. And within the platform, there's, you know, capture forms for KYC, there's notifications if something's coming up or something's overdue. And that's, you can show your customer as much as that contractual obligation as you want, but we've built it in a way that the customer sees it as my customer journey, the commitment this company has made to me.
So it's really visibility, isn't it?
It is visibility and helping people deliver what they say they'll do. And that was the frustration that we had in Taipei. It's just,
yeah,
we seem to agree to contracts and then we put them aside and they're put on a shelf and nobody ever sees them again. And then someone delivers a service and we think that, or is that the service that we agreed on? Where when I was younger working at MLC, I was the head of income streams, pensions and annuities for a couple of years. And the prospectus was your Bible. That's what you promised your customers. And you made sure IT knew about it. And you made sure customer service knew about it. And you made sure admin knew about it. And that's what you delivered. And nowadays, we seem to have gone away from that. It doesn't seem to matter what we contractually agree to. We just go and do whatever we think the customer wants.
Yeah. And as a customer, how many times have we just ticked that box on the, you know, on the screen that says, yes, I agree to everything, and we don't know?
Not really understood what it meant.
Yeah.
So Pathways makes that very visible.
And so how do you think your overseas experiences have helped you set that up and, I guess, navigate this first 12 months, 18 months of the business journey?
I think I've been very fortunate in the roles I've had to be on both sides. You know, I've been on both sides of joint ventures. I've been on both sides of contractual negotiations. I've been responsible for market entry, like the legal side of market entry for Indonesia and India for NAB. So I've seen the complexity, but also how clear communication can make that complexity go away. And that if you are really open and honest about your intentions, but very clear about your obligations, you can make life a lot easier for a lot of people. And I think that's really, you know, everything I have done through my career has been based on that type of work. But also nearly every core role that I've had through my career, I have worked for amazing people, like really decent people who are excellent at what they do. And you learn from them also to just do what you say you'll do. And I think I've tried to package that up into a platform that is as simple as possible. Whether people use it as, which we've got some customers using it for risk management, we've got some using it for a customer interface, we've got some using it for audit, and we've got some using it for just delivering their contracts. So all of the things that we hope they'd use it for, people are starting to use it for, which I'm thankful for.
And so when you were sort of started having discussions around the business, you had a core group of people who knew you, who knew what you'd been working on. How did you then expand your network here in Australia? And what are your observations of the way of doing business here in Australia that's different?
I guess I started with the, and I think this is why it took me so long to press the button and say, this is what I'm doing. is I started with a lot of trepidation because you hear all the podcasts, you read all the books, you see all the stories about how someone starts up a business. And that's not really me, and it's certainly not my style. So for me, it was sitting down with people and having conversations about my aspirations, about my frustrations, about what I wanted to achieve. And I think the tipping point came for me when I was sitting down with a young guy who I'd first met as a consultant. I was a client of his when he came up from Melbourne to Hong Kong in, I think, 2004. And then years later, he was working in the business bank strategy team for NAB, again, when I was head of strategy for NAB in Asia. And we didn't know each other well, but we quite respected each other. And we clearly enjoyed spending time together. And I saw something on LinkedIn that he was in Melbourne, which I, for some reason, didn't think he was. And I reached out to him, and 2 days later, we're having lunch together. And he told me his experiences. And he was the first guy who had left National Australia Bank to do their own thing. And there was a guy called Stuart Stoyan, and it was a business called Money Place, and he sold it to Liberty Financial. And it kind of had been through everything that I was going through, and he'd been through the textbook version of what I'd heard. And at the end of our lunch, he just said, "Look, how do I help you?" And I said, "Well, actually, I need some capital and I need some advice." And he said, "Well, I can help you with both of those." And then it was a case of just replaying that conversation with, you know, four or five people that I really respected that I'd known for years and years. And those people became my advisory board. So they became my advisory board just on a pro bono, "Look, let me help you." And that gave me the confidence to then, you know, raise a seed round and actually take that proof of concept that we had and turn it into a real business.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful. And I understand too that on your advisory board are a number of people that bring also an international lens and knowledge.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm really fortunate. We've got people who, I've met through you, Margo, David, who, you know, who's got a fantastic career, you know, 20 years in London and the Middle East and New York in promoting SaaS platforms, promoting the types of businesses that I have. Through to Dave Richards, who's, you know, I describe him as a crusty old banker, you know, who worked four or five banks and is retired now in Melbourne, knows
more about it than we'll ever, you know, care to forget. Yeah, yeah.
And knows everyone. And there's, you know, Adrian Hondros, and there's Wendy Geats, who's also done a stint overseas, who works for Lendlease. There's this group of people who know me very well, know my strengths, know my weaknesses, and I'm not shy to just pick up the phone and say, "Hey, how about this?" And, yeah. And I love that and I need that.
Yeah. Well, that brings that diversity, doesn't it? Diversity of thinking, diversity of thought, diversity of experience.
Yeah.
Now, you're back, your business seems to be flying along. How does life feel in Australia? Like, how have you gone settling into life here? And how do you think having a business has supported the lifestyle elements?
I'm not sure the business has supported the lifestyle.
Maybe not monetarily, but...
Yeah, not monetarily. Look, I think it's just the joy of meeting new people is still there, regardless of what country you're in.
Great.
And also the joy of connecting with people that you've had great relationships in the past. Mm. So it is all about people, but it's also about just being joyful and grateful about what you have. You know, I could sit here and lament the fact that I don't earn, you know, what I earned for most of my career, and I don't jump on aeroplanes the way I used to, and I don't live in the resorts, you know, on weekends that I used to. Or I can really enjoy the people around me and the surrounds around me. And I've also been very fortunate to have had one or two people in particular, my CTO in particular, Kevin Love. Kevin was in Hong Kong with me at Manulife, so he ran technology up there. And even when I was in Taipei and I had this idea and I thought I knew how to build it, you know, I'd throw it down to Kevin and say, "Hey, can you have a look at this and tell me what you think?" I think I was here for 3 months when he put his hand up and said, "Hey, can I join you?" And it was such a validation of, hey, I'm in the right city, I'm in the right place, I'm with the right people. You know, every time I look at Derek and you know, Derek and I go for walks with our dog around this area, I just think I'm where I should be. It's a great feeling.
And I think it's also a reward for the bravery of stepping off the expat train sometimes. You know, just as we talk about the bravery of going overseas, I think sometimes there is a sense of bravery about stepping back into the unknown when you've been away for such a long time. And will life continue to reward me? Will my career continue to reward me? And you have to step off to know, don't you?
Yeah. And look, particularly, you know, I didn't get sucked into the massive expat packages. You know, when I got asked to move from China down to Hong Kong, which was about 2005, that was kind of the end of the expat package, the big bonuses and the big housing allowances and things like that. You know, you're employed as in a local basis. So I was very fortunate that way. But a 15% tax rate is also a drug.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it's sort of hard to sort of say, well, what does the future hold if I move to Australia and hit 50% tax? And it's a scary thought.
We like to close all of our podcast chats with five quick questions. So I'd love to put those questions to you now. Living overseas taught me what about myself?
How privileged I am and how privileged my life's been, despite all the ups and downs. Living overseas has opened my eyes to how privileged I am.
Yeah, lovely. The number one skill I use today in my business is?
To listen to people and to treat people with dignity and respect.
Mm, beautiful. The best thing I have discovered since arriving home is?
Oh, that the adventure doesn't stop.
Oh, lovely, lovely. I think that's a big fear for many people, so that's great to hear. The first thing I'd encourage a new repat to do is?
This one, I thought long and hard about, Margot, when you sent me these questions, but my answer is quite simple: to take long walks and to not think too much and just to look around yourself, just to look around at the beauty that's around you.
Yeah, lovely. A word, song, or quote that best describes my time overseas is?
Ooh, the serious Andrew would say, Civentus non est remiga, which is the only Latin I know, which is, if there is no wind, row. But the cheeky side of me would say it would be Queen's song, Don't Stop Me Now.
Ah, excellent.
Yeah, I'm having such a good time. I'm having a ball. Like every single line in that song probably represents one weekend somewhere in Asia.
Yeah. Fantastic. Andrew, I've thoroughly enjoyed our chat. I really appreciate you sharing your insights, you know, with such grace. And we really wish you well for Pathways Digital and look forward to seeing the future story.
Thank you very much, Margot. I appreciate it. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review, share it with your friends and family, and subscribe for future episodes. For more information on our guests, please head to our website, insyncnetworkgroup.com, where you can check out the show notes and also find more information about our career advisory programs and fabulous community.